Marion just is, she loves recovery, and she is a three legacy member. And whenever we get together and start talking, it's just, it's awesome because how much you can see how much she loves recovery. So anyway, she was, don't take it against her. She was from California. She is in Knoxville, Tennessee now. So she is a Tennessean, you know. So anyway, here's Marion.
Hi, y'all. Hi, everyone. Marion Gibbs, alcoholic and an addict. And I say both of those because I'm going to tell you a story because I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I just thought I was going to give up drugs and everything was going to be okay. And my clean date is May 30th, 1987, but my sobriety date is July 12th, 1987. And what happened was I drank my way into sobriety. And because I'm thinking I'm going to get married and have 2.2 children and serve wine on the dinner table. I don't even like wine, and I don't like children, but that was the idea. So anyway, I'm thankful for the committee and all you who put the work together. I know you lost some members of the committee, and then some have coronavirus right now, and they can't make it. And the ones who've been sitting out at the table all weekend long, selling the shirts and registrations and making sure everything's running smoothly, thank you for your service. Because that's a hard job to do, to sit there all day, every day. And, you know, so I'm grateful for you guys to be here. And I got to say that, so... I'm from Southern California. I live outside of Los Angeles up in the high desert. And so we don't have, what is it called, poison ivy or poisonous sumac or poison oak. But apparently we do here in Tennessee. And I don't know that. And I'm trying to be of service. And I go help my mother and I go clean out her garden. And now I am covered in poison ivy. All up and down my legs, all over my arms. And so I had a sponsee here last night. She saw my legs, and I said, boy, this is going to look ugly tomorrow. She goes, well, gosh, can't you wear a long dress? Don't you have a maxi? And I said, well, yeah, but it's sleeveless, so they'll see my arms anyway. And I thought, you know, that's so sweet. She's thinking. She's embarrassed for me. That's thoughtful of her. And then I thought, she's not here. She's embarrassed for herself. I can't believe my sponsor went up looking like that. So if you see some weird stuff, it's just poison oak, poison ivy, whatever I got. So anyway, my home group is the Tennessee group, and we meet every Thursday night, and I have a sponsor, and her name is Cindy, and I gave you my full sobriety date, which is July 12th, 1987. And I'm really grateful for that, and I'm going to run through a real quick, because you don't know where I come from. You know, we got some new girls in here, and, you know, I'm in a dress, and my hair's done, and my makeup's on straight, my lipstick isn't all smeared, I don't have eyeliner all under my face. And you're like, well, you know, she didn't drink like me or use like me. She didn't do the things that I did. So I want to give you a brief story about what I was like. So I don't remember my first drink. I didn't know it was going to be that important, but I was smoking pot by the time I was 11. And then I added everything else in between. And I liked the effects produced by it. I liked the way it made me feel. It took away all that stuff that I had growing up in a home. I grew up in a pretty rough home. I got a lot of beatings. My brother is the class president. My sister's on homecoming court. And then there's me. And I can't get good attention, so I seek out bad attention. And seeking out that bad attention, I get to do what I want, but I have to pay the price. And I've always been willing to pay that price. And that price was beating. And so I lived that way, and alcohol was the great salve, and drugs took me to a place I didn't have to feel any of that stuff. And so I married at 19. I moved to Los Angeles, and he left me because everything was about me. And I found the nightclubs. And they took me out there, and they're dancing to... Madonna and Chaka Khan, and I'm standing there. I'm like, oh, my God, I don't know any of this. My first concert was Led Zeppelin, 1977, and, you know, I'm standing there, and they hand me a Long Island iced tea, and I'm like, yeah, and 8 Long Island iced teas later, I'm out there dancing to Madonna and Chaka Khan, ooh, and so, you know, and I'm having a lot of fun, but things were starting to happen, and, you know, I got arrested pulling into my garage October 30th, 1985. I told my roommate I was going to cut back after the Halloween party, but, you know, cut back, not stop. And so I got arrested, and I had to go to AA, and I went to one AA meeting, and the guy was a Skid Row drunk who lived in a cardboard box. He got sober and became a lawyer. I thought, geez, I'd go to AA too. I don't identify with that guy. And I keep on drinking, and they tell me there's a great bar next door. So I put my court card in the basket, and I went and got a beer and played darts. And I didn't hear the message. And I continued to drink and use like that, and I found about freebasing cocaine. And so that became a new whole habit for me. And one day I come home from work. I still had a job at the time. And my roommate moved out. She left me a note that said, "You scare me." And I was mad that she moved out. And I was mad because the rent was due. So I did what I could only do. I didn't pay any more rent. And now I have nobody looking at me with my drinking and using. I have 50 bags of garbage that I'm picking cigarette butts out of. I don't have any electricity, so I have an extension cord thrown up over the balcony that plugs in a stereo, a fan, and a lamp. I have maggots in my refrigerator and freezer because I don't have any power. And I'm okay with the way I'm living. The book says our alcoholic life becomes the only normal one we know. I'm okay with this. And I continue to live that way. And then I get arrested on, I had a drunk driving warrant. I had 8 warrants on that drunk driving. And I was also, my car was impounded. It had a half a kilo of cocaine in it. And so I have to come talk to the cops down in Van Nuys. And, you know, I believe in you play, you pay. And so the cops want to pin that on me. I wasn't in the car, so they couldn't. But they're trying to force me into telling whose it is. And I can't do that. And I'm not going to do that. And so I go back to jail on that warrant. And they send me down to Women's County Jail. It was Sybil Brand Institute at the time. And I have to go back to court, and I'm lined up in line with all you bitches up there, and I don't want to ride the bus with you. I think I deserve my own bus. So I'm all cuffed up, and I just keep stepping back, till I'm the last girl standing. And I'm like, nice, I got my own bus coming. No, I don't. They put me on the men's county bus. And you know you're looking really skanky when you're on that men's county bus, and you ain't getting one catcall. And I get out of jail, and I go beg somebody to come get me, and I get back to my apartment, and my things are gone. And I'm like, who stole my stuff? And a neighbor came out, and he said, "Marion, your folks were here." Well, I don't want to call my mom and dad. I'm 25 years old. How am I going to tell them this? And so I call my sister-in-law. She said, "Marion, your dad had a heart attack." Because what happened is they broke into my apartment, and they smelled that rotting stench from that food that was rotted in that refrigerator and freezer, and they're looking for my dead body. And they're standing in the chaotic mess of my life. They're like, what is going on with our girl? See, because I don't have any concern or care about anybody. So I wait until he's out of the hospital and I borrow a car because mine's still impounded. And I have a story about why I'm living the way I'm living, and it's nothing that I'm doing. And I go back to that apartment for about another week. And then there's a knock on the door. And I look out that door, and there's my mom and dad. And I open it. They say, "Marion, you can't keep living like this. You got to get your life in order. Come up to Lancaster." And I drove up there, and I went away for the weekend. My folks got my car out of impound, and I went away drinking and using for the weekend with my biker boyfriend. And I walk in the door, and my mom says, "You've been lying all along. You have 2 options. You get help, or we're going to drop you to the streets of L.A. And I'm debating, you know, to die an alcoholic death or to live by spiritual principles. I'm like, So I go, I guess I'll get help. And my parents walked me down to Antelope Valley Hospital. There were 7 guys sitting in that room, and I thought, man, I hope that's where I'm going, because my primary purpose were those 7 men. And even though I'm married, I got a boyfriend. I had that biker boyfriend, and then I got a boyfriend in treatment. I mean, really, I like men. So what happened is the people carried the message. But I joined another fellowship. I joined Narcotics Anonymous, and I got a sponsor that didn't give direction, who didn't use any literature. And that's what I did with my sobriety. And I did the treatment center idea, 90 meetings, 90 days. The book says try not drinking for a year, right? But that's excess, especially when you're not alcoholic. So I did that, and I moved in with that boyfriend who's a chronic 30-day relapser. And he came home one day. I said, "Baby, if you're going, I'm going." And I went out and got some dope and got some tequila and scored some dope, and there I was. And I spent another 8.5 months out there. I moved 9 times my last year. And I'm going to tell you about my last week. So I get my boyfriend into rehab at the end of May because he's a terrible drug addict. It's terrible to see him like that. So I'm not going to do that anymore because I can see I have a problem, but I can drink. And so in a matter of 6 weeks, I'm going to tell you just my last week of drinking. So in the last week of drinking, I have the good idea, 4th of July weekend, to go to Mexico with the girls. And I know what happens when I go to Mexico. I drink tequila. And the last thing I know, I come to, I got a black eye, a fat lip, cracked ribs, no panties, parked in the desert, and my money's gone. I'm like, oh, geez. I drive back to the hotel where I don't have a key, and the maid lets me in. And I thought, they can't go far. I drove, so I sleep it off. They still weren't back, so I laid by the pool. At the end of the day, I realized they're not coming back. And I came up across that border, and apparently I got in a fist fight with my friends. And I tried to run them over with my car. And they had the federales take them to the border, and they called my family and said, she's crazy. They thought I was on drugs. To my knowledge, I didn't do anything other than alcohol that night. But that's what happens when I drink. And the next day, my head says, you can have two, just two. And the next day after that, I only have two. By the third day, I'm drinking like it's ginger ale. So July 11th, 1987 is the night of my last drunk. Not my worst one, just my last one. I'm on a blind date. Let's say I'm on a blind date with Ben. Really, guy's got to be desperate. I got the girl for you, man. I'm still sporting that big old black eye. And I'm in this place in Beverly Hills drinking with Ben. But I look across the room and there's Soren, the man I've been waiting for my whole life. And I leave my date to go home with another man. And in the middle of doing the nasty, I got a moment of clarity. And I'm like, dude, I got to go. And he's like, now? And I said, right now. And I left. You know what? Because when you're a woman like me and you're living like that and you're selling yourself so cheap. And I've done that repeatedly time and time again. And it wasn't the first time. And I knew it wasn't going to be the last time. And at some point in your life, you just can't keep going anymore. And so my boyfriend gets out of rehab, and I loved him, and he's telling me he's sleeping along the railroad tracks. So all I can do is imagine that he's eating food out of that garbage, and I knew I couldn't help him because I couldn't help myself. I knew I was beyond human aid at that point by the time I got to the rooms. And, I went to ask people in Al-Anon, how do you detach with love? It was the dumbest thing I ever heard. But I stayed in the meetings, and I joined CA and AA. And I got a sponsor that didn't give direction, and she was a gossip. I got all of Brittany's juicy stuff. I'm like, geez, Brittany. And everything about Carol, everything about Cassidy. And I wasn't going to talk about those men, those maggots, and 50 bags of garbage. And so I hung out with her for a while, and I realized that she's a gossip, and she wants me to do an inventory, and I hadn't even done the first three steps. So I was hanging with the boys in AA, because that's what I like to do, and I got engaged 3 weeks. Of sobriety. And so what happened was they're getting direction from the book from their sponsor, and I'm not getting that. And I go to a couple old timers. You know a woman who uses the book who'll take me through the steps. Yeah, honey, here you go. Vicky. It was this awful, polite, nice, sweet woman who used to carry the message while I was in that treatment center. I go, I'm not going to call her. So I suffer a while longer, and I go to somebody else. I go, you know a woman who uses the book? He goes, yeah, here you go, honey. Vicky. God. She was like, she took her clothes off in a drug-induced psychosis in a nut ward, and I took my clothes off because I'm a tramp, and that's the only thing we had in common. But that woman had 8 years of sobriety, and she sat down, and I wanted to be just a drug addict. She goes, well, did you drink? Because I was in an AA meeting when I asked her, and she said, yes. She goes, let's address your drinking to see if you belong here. Because she would have been kind enough to send me to the proper fellowship that I needed to be. Because, see, I don't think I'm really alcoholic. So we read the doctor's opinion, and I was like, oh, my God, I'm bodily and mentally different. That's why my head says you can have just three drinks. Stay away from the tequila. Eat dinner first. Oh, yeah, that's what I'm going to do. Just get an eight ball. That'll be enough. And then it's not enough, and then I'm going out the door again. And one more time, and I didn't understand all of that. I didn't understand that I had that obsession that was always going to win. And so I said, oh, my God, Vicky, I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. But see, I'm still looking for that out. And I got that Bill's story closed that up for me. Fear sobered me a bit, but I drank again and got loaded again. Self-knowledge got me sober again, but I got loaded again. All those geographics, everything Bill did, I did. All those things he did, he closed those doors one by one. And I realized that I had done everything that he talked about. And it closed the door for me ever thinking that I could get out and go back to successfully drinking or using. And then I had to come, and then we read chapters 2 and 3, the insidious insanity of the first drink. Because you used to tell me it was the first drink or the first hit, or it was the first of this that was going to get you. And I said, no, it's not. It's like the fifth. What are you talking about? See, I didn't understand that first concept when I got here. So I understood what she was talking about. And I read that. But then I got to come to believe in step two. And I'm going to get up to the steps. I don't have a relationship with God. And I know some people think if you just believe, then you've done step three and get on your knees and do step three. Didn't work that way for me. Because I got all these ideas about God. And I love we agnostics. Because it talks about laying aside the prejudice of the ideas that I got. So I moved down here to the Bible Belt Company group. And all you people down here were forced into church and altar calls. And I get a lot of women between 5 and 10 who are struggling. And they struggle because they don't have a relationship with God. Because they got here with an idea of God that has never worked for them. That they are terrified for. And how are we going to turn our will and life over to a care of God that I don't even like? So I have all these prejudices. I went to church. They made me sing Jesus Loves Me, but it meant nothing to me. So it asked me to lay aside my prejudice. It asked me to ask myself what these spiritual terms mean to me and do not let them deter me from honestly asking myself what they mean. I started going through We Agnostics with my sponsor, and then I said, I don't get it. She said, read it again. I read it 20 more times. I said, Vicki, I don't get it. She goes, read it again. See, I'm looking at it. It says agnostic. I'm not agnostic. But that was the problem. I got a closed mind. I had to look at it from a different point of view. And I start reading this chapter with an open, fresh mind and ask myself these questions. So I think I get it when it says when we're driven to AA by a self-imposed crisis, we can't postpone or evade. We have to fearlessly face the proposition that God is everything or else he is nothing. He either is or he isn't. I believed he was. I called her up. I said, I got this. Until I get to the next line. Arrived at this point, we're squarely confronted with the question of faith. I don't have that kind of faith. I believe, but I don't have faith. Talks about getting off that bridge of reason to the shore of faith. I said, Vicki, I can't do it. She says, Marion, you have to. I said, I can't. I know my life is a mess. I know run by me, it's a disaster. But I can't. She says, if you can't do this, you're going to pick up again, Marion. You'll never be able to stay clean and sober. And so I kept reading it and kept asking myself those questions because this is where I determine my relationship with God. And near the end of that chapter, it's one of my favorite lines. It says, if we help clear, you know, with our testimony, sweep away prejudice, allow you to think honestly and search diligently within yourself, then you can join us. And those were the things I needed to do in order to understand step two and coming to believe that God could restore me to sanity and I could make a relationship with him. So then my sponsor gave me step three. He says, just what do we mean by that and just what do we do? So they required action. I have to be convinced, and Tara talked about it, that my life run by self-will can hardly be a success. Well, I get engaged at 3 weeks sober, but I can't see all the other stuff. And even in sobriety, just because I'm sober doesn't mean that my life is not run by me. It says we're almost always in collision, even though our motives are good. So David and I were going to Texas. We were taking a friend who was dying of cancer. I saved the overhead bin. I'm waiting for David to put the luggage over here. He's over here. I go, no, David, no, right here. And he's putting it up here. I go, no, David, I saved this whole bin. Just put it right here. And he's looking at me, and he's putting it away. And my head is saying, shut up. But my mouth is saying, right here. So my motives are good, but yet I'm still trying to run the show, even in sobriety. And it's crazy. And so I had to be convinced that doing that thing all the time, always in collision with others, even though my motives are good. And I'm only concerned about myself, my resentments, and my self-pity. And selfishness and self-centeredness has always been the root of my trouble. And she gave me that assignment to go out and see where I practice those things on a daily basis. And when I came back and I said, oh my God, Vicki, I had no idea. And then she says, and just what do we do? Marion, it says we quit playing God. First, we quit playing God. It did not work. Next. So I had to stop playing God. And I had to stay out of that stuff. And I had to keep my mouth shut. And I tried not to be in collision with people. And I tried not to run the show. And all those things were going on. And so she asked me at the end of that week, she goes, how's it going? I go, oh my God, it's so much better. I feel so much better at peace. And then we read those promises at the third step, before the third step prayer, right? And it told me what I was going to get. I said, I really liked it. I felt those things, Vicki. She said, well, would you like to make it permanent? And I said, I did. And we got on our knees and I did that third step prayer. And I cried. It was the first time I prayed on my knees out loud with another human being. And then I had to immediately go into that fourth step, my resentments, my fear, and my sex. And so I listed them. And it says we look at it for an entirely different angle. It tells us to look at it three times. And it says, I got to look at it from a different angle. And I practice that resentment prayer. You know, who topped that list is my mom and dad. My dad beat me. My mother stood by and watched, right? So I go down that list and I start making the principles, institutions, people, institutions, and principles with whom I'm angry. And I put those down. And then behind every resentment is fear. I know some people talk about fear of spiders and flying. It doesn't say that, because if you look at it, fear drives all my resentments. So I listed the fears that were driving my resentments. And it says we ask God to remove those fears. Direct our attention to what he'd have us be. Not do, be. And then my sex conduct. And if you were a girl like me, all I wanted was to have a clean slate. I didn't want to be the girls that slept around the rooms. I did that in the bars and at the party houses. I wanted a little bit of decency and integrity in my life. And my sponsor came over at the fifth step. It says, we're prepared for a long talk. I cried for 7 straight hours. I cried. I told things. I was the most intimate I've ever been. I've been intimate with a lot of people, but I have never been intimate in the fashion like that. And I just shared everything with her. And at the end of the fifth step, it says, we take the book down. We went over what I was supposed to do. And she left my home, and I took that hour and I prayed from the bottom of my heart that I got to know God better. I asked myself those questions, and I tell people that the silence was deafening, because it says our fears fall from us. We can look the world in the eye. We're at perfect peace and ease. And I sat there and I'm like, there was nothing going on in my head, and I was so afraid because I'd never had that in my life. And I picked up the phone when my hours was done, and I called Vicky and I said, oh, my God. And she said, well, that's what it's supposed to be, Mary. And I said, well, it scared me. She goes, well, are you ready for step 6? I said, yes. She goes, well, are you entirely ready? Well, no. I mean, really, who is? Because it tells us in here, it says, if we can answer to our satisfaction on the previous page those questions, then we look at step 6, which we emphasize willingness as being indispensable. And then we ask that, can he now take them all, every one, if we still cling to something? We ask God. If we will not let go, we ask God for his help. So it facilitated a big discussion between my sponsor and I. So we talked about step 6, and then she goes, well, why don't we read step 6 in the 12 and 12? Now, in the beginning of the foreword of the fourth edition, it says sweeping changes have happened in society and in AA at large. But the integrity of the literature always remains the same. And so the word integrity means whole and undivided, right? So my sponsor included the 6 steps. She included the 12 and 12 in these steps because it doesn't give you much, but it facilitated a discussion in step 6. So so it says, this does not mean that we expect all of our character defects to be lifted out as they drive. The drive to drink was, a few of them may be, but with most of them, we shall have to be content with patient improvement. The key words, entirely ready, underline the fact that we want to aim at the very best we know or can learn, right? So now I have to learn how I'm going to do this. And then we read on further in here, and it says here that, therefore, it seems plain that few of us can quickly or easily become ready to aim at spiritual and moral perfection. We want to settle for only as much perfection as will get us by in life, according, of course, to our own various and sundry ideas of what will get us by. I've just done just enough my entire life. I do just enough in a marriage, just enough at my job, just enough at school. I just do just enough to get by. And when is that in AA not going to be enough for me? When is the day that I'm like, I've done just enough, that I'm willing to pay the price, pick up a drug, hit that pipe, have another tequila? What am I going to do, right? And then it says, so the difference between the boys and the men is the difference between striving for a self-determined objective and for the perfect objective, which is of God. So Vicky asked me what my objectives were, my self-determined objectives. Well, I want those glaring defects out. I'm getting mad. I don't just get mad. I get enraged. And you'd be like, oh, my God. So I want those defects removed that embarrass me, that you see. But then it says in here, so not much spiritual effort is involved in avoiding excesses, which will bring us punishment anyway. But when we face up to the less violent aspects of these same defects, then where do we stand? See, because I have these ones that you don't even know that I have. I want the ones you see that make me look bad removed. That's my self-determined objective. Like I look at, I'm drawing a blank, Tara, and she looks so pretty today, and her makeup was beautiful, and her hair, and she carries herself well, and she walks into that room, and I don't even know her. Bitch. Because I got envy in my heart. And she could be a girl with 35 days or 35 years, and I don't want to get up and help her because I got this envy, and it keeps me separated. My husband and I were once at a meeting, and I said, women are so catty. He said, why? I go, look at us when we walk in the room. Every single one. You walk in, every eye goes up and down. We weigh our competition immediately. It's true, women, isn't it? Yes. And so he goes, well, why do you all do that? I said, I have no idea, because we always feel so inadequate. And so, you know, I got this envy that goes leaving in my heart, and you don't even know I have it. And then I'm at a meeting. It was a beautiful sunny day. It's 7 a.m. All the windows are open in the meeting hall. All the lights are in. I come in a few minutes early. I'm not there too early. But I walk in, and there's a guy sitting there in sunglasses. And I'm like, oh, God, would you look at that guy? He's so hip, slick, and sick. Blah, 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 blah. And I just talking bad in my head about him. And after the meeting, he got up with his cane. Because I'm judgmental. I don't even know the story. I don't even know anything about the guy. But I sat there for an hour bad-mouthing some dude in the meeting. It's like, oh, my God, Marion. And I came back, and I talked to Vicky. I'm like, oh, my God, these things keep me so separated. They separate me from you, and they separate me from God. I had no idea. Because, see, I'm looking at those defects in my past. I'm looking at them on the sheet on my inventory. Those were the things in my past. But they're present in my life. And if I'm not aware of the presence of them, I'm going to continue to act on them. And I said, Vicky, what do I have to do? I'm entirely ready. So then we got out, and we looked at the seven-step prayer. And we discussed taking that, have all of me, good and bad. Remove from me every single character defect that stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out to do your bidding. God's work, right? So we talked about that, and then we also read the seventh step in here. And she said, Marion, I want you to be able to practice. This is the first step. It really talks about character building, not character. If I'm asking God to remove the character defects, I have to build character. I have to build character. I don't know how to build character. I don't even know what character is. You know, when I first got here, she goes, you know, you're going to have to live by spiritual principles. Well, what are those? I mean, I don't really have any. I don't even have an idea. She goes, why don't we start with you being honest about everything? And that was, really? Everything? And I had a hard time with that. So I go out to lunch, and I'm out with Carol, and she's like, oh, that waitress forgot the charges for our drinks. Don't say anything. And I'm like, oh. Then I go out with Cassidy. And Cassidy's cheating on her husband. And I'm like, Carol's cheating the waitress. She's cheating on her husband. My sponsor's telling me I can't do those things. Now I'm a little irritated. I'm a little pissed. I storm into my meeting hall. And there's an old man named John Barry sitting there. Thank God for that old man. I go, Carol's doing this. Cassidy's doing that. And Vicky says I can't do those things. And he opened the book to chapter 3 more about alcoholism. Alcoholics of our type and alcoholics of our kind. He said, Marion, you're a chronic hopeless alcoholic. And if you want to stay sober, clean and sober, you're going to have to live by spiritual principles. And if they're an alcoholic and a drug addict like our type and they're doing those things, they're not going to be able to stay clean and sober. And if they are not alcoholic of our type, then they can do whatever the hell they want. But you're a hopeless chronic alcoholic addict. It made sense to me. So I had that list of those character defects that were going on in my life. I'm greedy. I'm self-centered. I'm self-seeking. I'm intolerant. I'm patient. I'm envious, right? I have a whole list of things that are wrong with me. She goes, Marion, I want you to begin to practice the character assets. I don't even know what those are. She said, get a dictionary and look them up. And then start putting them into practice. And I want to hear where you've fell short on that and where you've put them into practice. So I got engaged at 3 weeks sober, as I told you, and I got sick, and he was so thoughtful. He got me a pillow and a blanket. He went and got me some soda, you know, something to settle my stomach, and I really liked that. I was like, oh, that's pretty cool, because growing up, where I grew up was, stay in your room and don't bug us, right? So somebody's paying attention to me the way I think I need to have attention. And then I got sick again. And then I threw up all over the floor. He said, don't worry about it. I'll clean it up. Wow. Because as a kid, I had to clean it up myself if I missed the toilet. He cleaned that all up. And then he gets sick. He goes, do you think you could give me a pillow? Yeah. How about a blanket? I'm so cold. Yeah, I could do that. Do you think you could go get me some ginger ale or some soup? I don't feel good. What? God, you're bugging me. Because why? It's all about me. All I think about is myself. He's cutting into my time, my TV show, my this. I'm selfish and self-centered. I don't know anything about charity. I don't know anything about compassion. I didn't come to you with that. And I had to begin to practice it. Because in step 7 in here, it says, it talks about character building in here. But whatever we had to choose between character and comfort, the character building was lost in the dust of our chase after what we thought was happiness. And it talks about character building 3 or 4 times in step 7. And I don't know how to build that character. So the next time that guy got sick, would you like a pillow and a blanket? I'm going to go out and get you some ginger ale and some soup. Would you like that? I don't feel those things. But I did those things because it says the best that we can know or we can learn. I had to learn to put those into practice. And that's the hard thing for me. I don't like to do the practice work. It's all about me. But if I want my life to change, I have to put it into good use. There's a story about Bill Wilson that he wrote or he told about Bill's thoughts on principles versus character defects. I spoke at an AA group's anniversary in St. Paul, Minnesota, and left the members with a riddle. If the principles of 12-step recovery are not the 12 steps, then what are the principles? I'll read it again. If the principles of 12-step recovery are not the 12 steps, then what are the principles? I returned to the same meeting about a year later to present a sponsee with a sobriety medallion, and a few people approached me with the following comment. I've been looking all year since your talk in the literature for the principles, and I can't find them. My answers to these group members was the same one I gave my sponsees. The principles of 12-step recovery are the opposite of my character defects. So it was about me learning how to practice those principles, the opposite of my character defects, and then they become my character assets. And I have this great little, it was a meditation and it really struck me. It says, I once asked my grandmother, why shouldn't we go after pleasant things, Granny? It's only human. And what's wrong with wanting to stay away from unpleasant things? She didn't argue with me. She just told me to eat an amla fruit. It was easier said than done. The fruit was so sour that I wanted to spit it out. But she stopped me. Don't give up. Keep chewing. Out of love for her, I did. And the sourness left. The fruit began to taste sweeter. And sweeter. Granny, this is delicious, I said. But you didn't like it at the outset. You wanted to spit it out. And that is how it is with spiritual disciplines. See, because these things about me always thinking of myself, they've become sweeter when I've been able to think about you. Because these steps are about moving me away from myself out to God and my fellows. And that brings us to step 8. It says, now we need more action because faith without works is dead. And it says, we have a list of all persons we have harmed and to whom we were willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. We subjected ourselves to a drastic self-approval. Now we go out to repair our fellows and repair the damage done in the past, right? So now I have to go make that list and I have to look at it because my sponsor then had me read step 8. And we sat down and we read step 8 and the 12 and 12 together, which gave me some additional information. I love it that it says, we make an accurate and unsparing survey of the human wreckage left behind in my wake. I have left a whole host, and you talked about that, of human wreckage. People's lives I destroyed, and I don't even care. My parents who stood there and break into my apartment and smell that rotting stench and think their daughter's dead. My mother once called me, I said, she goes, Marion, we're so worried about you. I said, Mother, when you see my picture on TV that says, do you know this girl? Then you worry. Get off my back. My grandmother had been out for a matter of 3 months. My grandfather was the town drunk. He laid in the gutter that people stepped over. My mother never had friends to her home. She never had a birthday until I threw her one for her 80th. We're not allowed to talk about drinking. We're not allowed to talk about her father. When they walked me down to that hallway, she said to me, you have stirred up so much shit in my life. Because my mother tried to put that down, right? And it says, it talks about what are these harms, how I harm them emotionally, mentally, physically, spiritually, and financially. How do I give back to my parents that emotional security I robbed, that they laid in bed night after night worrying about me? When my grandmother flew home early and I talked to my aunt, she said, I asked her, Mom, what's going on? How come you came home early? She goes, I can't. Marion's drinking and using so bad, it's just tearing Lois up. I can't stand another day of looking at it. See, because I'm one of the girls who wants to justify, you didn't see me do it, so it really doesn't matter to you. And so I love this when it talks about the three obstacles that we're going to face, right? And the first one, it talks about forgiveness. That's the very first one. I'm getting ready to go out and make amends to the things I did, but what about the things you did with me? How am I going to forgive my parents who beat me? But yet, a lot of times, I set the ball rolling. I myself started it all. And so this is very interesting. My dad turned 90 this year, and my family flew out for his 90th birthday party. And my nephew's 35, and he came in about a week early, and I took him a couple places with my folks, out to dinner and then out to a movie. And so he and I are hiking one day, and he says, Auntie, can I ask you something? I said, sure, Scotty. He said, I know you had a really hard childhood. My dad's told stories. I said, yeah, it was pretty tough. He says, but I notice you treat your mom and dad really well. How is that possible? And it's about that ability to forgive that I found here in Alcoholics Anonymous. They, like me, are sick too. And my sister has had some trouble with this. And I said, Janice, I have the 12 steps that takes me through that. You don't have that option, but you do have the Lord's Prayer. Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. I'm asking God for 100% forgiveness for my own life, but I'm only willing to grant you 10. That's all you're going to get, Anthony, 10%. But I'm asking God for the same measure. If I want 100%, I have to be willing to grant Anthony that 100%. Because why should he get less than what I get? We're all equal in God's eyes. The second obstacle, it says, is that we hit another solid obstacle that I have to make it's pretty shocking that I have to go make a face-to-face. So I'm sitting there. I had to go up to Sacramento. That girl I took to Mexico and that I beat up and then I tried to run over, I drove up there to make an amends to her. And I like in here because it tells us in the seventh step that we have to find out what those character defects were. I need to go tell them. I stole my dad's coin collection. And when I got caught, he said, why would you do that? And I said, I don't know, because I don't know. When I'm drinking, I don't know. And then the third snag I have, it says, is that we never hurt anybody. And I told you about that story with my grandmother. She never even saw me drink, and I never even saw her the 3 months I was here. My mother said, we're going to come down and pick you up on the way to the airport so you can visit with your grandmother. But I went to Jeremiah's house on Friday, and I'm just going to go over there and party on Friday night. I'll be home. But now it's Sunday morning. I make it home. I haven't slept in 2 days. I'm drunk. I take a shower. I put on fresh clothes, and I lay down on my couch waiting for my mom and dad with my grandmother to pick me up. Became paramount to all other interests. I loved my grandmother, but I can't do those things. And then I don't want to have to acknowledge the harm that I caused her and what I stirred up with her. So now I have this list of all the people I'd hurt and how I had hurt them, and I had to go out and repair the damage of my past. And I love what they do in the big book because they give us some really clear-cut examples The first one it says is most alcoholics owe money. I think it's funny that we open with money. And I think maybe because that one was the easiest one to do, right? And it says we do not dodge our creditors. And then it says our drinking, we must lose our fear of creditors no matter how far we have to go, for we are liable to drink if we are afraid to face them. I hadn't filed taxes for 4 years. My last 3 years, I never drew a clean or sober breath. And I've moved 9 times. I have no paperwork. I have nothing. And I hired an accountant, and my old accountant that I used to go to, and I go sit across from him, and he goes, well, what's your situation now, Marion? And I start telling him what I'd done. I said, well, I'm living with this guy, and I'm putting him through college, and I bought this house, and I have a couple car payments. And he's like, but you're not married? I said, no. He goes, well, I can put you married. You'll save a lot of money. I put my head down on his desk. He goes, Marion, you're not going to get caught. What are you worried about? I go, that's not what I'm worried about, Scott. He goes, well, then what are you worried about? I go, if I can lie about this, what else can I lie about? I go, you need to file me single. And then I had to fill out that form to the IRS, every debt I owed, every payment I had to make every month. And then I sent that form to them, and I had $300 left a month. And they said, great, we'll take it. And then for the next 3 years, I wrote the IRS a check for $300 every single month. And I cleared up that debt. I owed my parents money. And I asked them how much I owe. And my dad says, it really doesn't matter. I said, yes, it does. I need to pay it. Well, I know in their will that my rehab cost them 12 grand way back then. And so I'm out of the will 12 grand. But there was other bits of money that I took from them. When I made that amends to my dad, I stole his coin collection. My dad's a blue-collar worker. We didn't come from money. And I stole that when I was in high school. And when he asked me why, when I got caught, I said, I couldn't tell him why. I don't know. But I knew by the time I did that inventory and looked at those character defects why I did that. He said, why would you do that? I said, Dad, I need to make amends. I said, let me tell you why I did it. Two of my girlfriends, their fathers had died, and her mother's got Social Security. They got $20 a week allowance. I got $2 a week allowance. $2 isn't enough when you smoke, drink, do weed, do other drugs, right? I said, I'm so terrified that I'm going to be excluded from my group of friends that I'm willing to steal from my own family. And I robbed that trust that we had, that respect that you had for me that I might have had for you, because none of it matters, because it's always been about me. And I want to set this matter right with you, Dad. What do I have to do? He says, Marion, there's no way you could make that right. I took that coin collection and I went to that cigarette machine and 35 cents a pack and I pulled out those coins. I took that money and I handed it to that dope dealer for 4 ounces of weed for 10 bucks. Expensive coin collection that I got face value for. But he let me pay back some other money. He says, you just keep paying me $100 a month until I tell you. And so I went out and paid it. So then the second one, and it says, perhaps we've committed a criminal offense. Who hasn't done that, right? And then it says, reminding ourselves that we have decided to go to any length to find a spiritual experience. I don't remember agreeing to that when I got sober. My sponsor asked if I was willing to go to any length, and I said yes. But I didn't hear her say to have a spiritual experience. But by this point, I'm willing to. And then it says, we ask that we be given the strength and direction to do the right thing, no matter what the personal consequences may be. We may lose our position or reputation or face jail, but we are willing. We have to be. We must not shrink at anything. So I had 8 warrants on that drunk driving. I can't ever make it to court. I've talked myself into a job at my girlfriend's law firm. I'm just brand new sober. I know I have a warrant because my boyfriend's in jail, and I want to go visit him. And I go, but I'm not sure I have a warrant. And the cop says, well, why don't you come on down? We'll look. I'm like, oh, no, no, no. Why don't you just let me know so I could go take care of that? So I do have a warrant. And so I just sat on that for a while. And then what happened was I went to my employer. I said, I have to go to court tomorrow. And he said, why? I said, because I have a warrant and I need to clear it up. He goes, well, what do you have a warrant for? I said, drunk driving. He says, well, you're not going to go alone. One of us is going to go with you. I go, oh, no, no, no. It's okay. I'm just going to go take care of it. He goes, no, you're not. And he brings in the other two partners. And we start discussing it. And Bob Barda says, yeah, I'll go with you. I'll take you. But the problem is, I don't know where I stand on those drug charges. So now I have to say, well, I guess I need to tell you the whole story. And I have to be worried about losing my I didn't have much of a reputation, but my job. And I told them the story. I told them about the half a kilo of cocaine. And my employer went with me to court, and the room is packed with people who got drug and alcohol problems. And he stands before the judge. And the judge says, Mr. Barda, this is just the tip of the iceberg. And I'm like, oh, my God, here it comes. He goes, look at this room. Every single one of these people got a problems with drugs and alcohol. And your girl here wrote letters from treatment. I wrote two letters while I was in treatment. Not that I stayed sober after treatment, but I wrote those letters, and they got into my file. And she's trying to do the right thing. And he said, all I need her to do is go fill out these forms and we'll dismiss all charges against her. But I had to be willing to face the consequences. And then the last one says, the chances are that we have domestic problems. And those were the hard ones. Because see, when I was engaged at 3 weeks of sobriety, I went on a cruise at 9 months of sobriety. And there's a really good-looking guy, and I'm with a bunch of girls, and we all got the hots for him. But my ego's in play, and I need to have that guy. And I have sex with that guy, because it's always been about me. And I was devastated. I was devastated, and I got home, and I called my sponsor. I said, Vicky, I'm not drinking, and I'm not doing any dope, but nothing in my life has changed. What do I have to do? And so what happened was she encouraged me not to tell him. Well, I'm going to be marrying him. I need to be honest. And I went and told that man, and I broke his heart. And for the next 7 years of that relationship, every time we got in a fight, he called me a dirty whore. Because I didn't want to follow sponsor direction. And that marriage was never going to sustain that. But yet I did those things. Then it talks about the rest of it, whatever the situation is. It says there's a long reconstruction ahead. We must take the lead. So I'm going to tell you about my parents. So my dad is 90 years old. When David and I sold our business and decided to come to Tennessee, I offered to bring him. And at first they said, yeah, we're going to come, we'll come. And then they didn't come. And I said, Mom, we've sold the business, I sold the home, we got to go. And 2 years ago, there's been starting to have some problems, and she says, your daddy and I are going to move to Tennessee, we're going to need some help. So this is so funny, because my brother is a state senator in California, and my sister was an executive in a Fortune 500 company, and then there's me. I've been in and out of jail, I've been married 3 times. I mean, I haven't used the best judgment. my mom says, we're going to need your help. And I moved my mom and dad. I flew out to California, and I spent 5 weeks packing up their house. And I put them on a plane. And I came back, and I was going to be driving out the next day, and I was washing the laundry because they left their washer and dryer in this little kitchen set. And I just start bawling. I'm upheaval bawling. Because I realize that I'm taking my parents away from their life that they've, the only life they've known for the last 63 years. They're never going to see their friends again. And the reason that they're coming is because it's the final chapter. And I get to be a part of that final chapter. Because how do I give back that emotional security, all the things I've robbed from my parents? My dad has been in the hospital more than not in the last 6 months. Most of my time has been devoted to his care and taking care of my mother. In May, my dad had a near-death experience, and I'm with him while it's happening. His face is light, his blood pressure is down, his oxygen's at 76, his heart rate's down. And he says, he sees his dad, But yet he's still talking to me, and he's talking to his dad. There's my granddad. Hi, granddad. And he's telling me about his dad, granddad getting him drunk. Look at all the babies. I can't believe all these babies. And my dad's not a God guy. He goes, Marion, it's so beautiful. God is so beautiful. And I'm just talking to him, and I'm holding his hand. And the nurse is watching this. He said, who are these people? I go, it's his dad and his grandfather. And I said, is grandma there? And he goes, no. I don't see mom anywhere. And my dad goes, go home. He's talking to somebody up there. And this goes on for about 15 minutes. And my dad startles. And I go, what? He goes, I don't know. They made all this racket. And then they just slammed the door on me. I go, well, that wasn't very nice. And the next thing that happens is my dad's blood, oxygen rate went from 76 to 93. And the nurse is like, what just happened here? I've never seen this in my life. And I'd called my husband and I'd called the rest of my family. I said, Daddy's crossing over. You need to come. And so David saw my dad's eyes. He was so at peace. And we stepped out into the hallway and the nurse said, I had never seen anything like that in my life. I don't even know what that was. But I know what that was. And we got my dad into assisted living. And a week ago, he fell and he broke his hip. And then they crashed him. And his blood pressure was 60 over 23. And they raced him into ICU and they called me because I'm his power of attorney. A girl like me gets to be the power of attorney for my parents. And I said, it's a DNR. Yet my father still lives. This morning, I missed the morning panel. Not Tara, but I missed the morning one because I went to the hospital. And I held my dad's hands. And I talked to him and I got him something to drink. Because that's what Alcoholics Anonymous and DAA and CA had taught me to do. Was to step up and start living by these spiritual principles. That they were impossible for me to do at any other time in my life. And all of those moments have prepared me for where I stand now. When it says we don't regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. My past is my greatest asset because I can help other people. But it also has allowed me to become who I am today, as the woman I am today, because of all of those things, because of all of those hard lessons that I had to learn. And I'm grateful for the opportunity that I have. That my parents go to sleep every night knowing that I'm clean and sober. I carry the message up at Morgan County Corrections. It's a men's prison. I've done corrections work since I got sober. I used to go to Lancaster State Prison and Tehachapi State Prison. And my mom and dad would go, well, have fun with your inmates tonight. Thanks, Mom. I went to a maximum security prison with guns. I go to ones where they put a sticking vest on you and because they like to stick people. And my mom and dad are good with that because they know I'm here with you guys. They know I'm here in a fellowship that has rallied around when the hardest times of your life happen. In Bill's story, one of my favorite lines, it says in there, for if an alcoholic fails to enlarge and perfect his life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he can't get through the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he does not work, he will drink again. And if he drinks, he will die. And then faith will be dead indeed. With us, it is just like that. Because what is it? This is one of those certain trials and low spots ahead. My husband's father had a massive stroke a couple years ago. His mother now has dementia. My mother is in early stages of dementia. And that's how I ended up getting that. I go over and I change the sheets on her bed and I do a couple loads of laundry and I take out the garbage and I read the mail and I tell her what she needs to do with certain things. And I go out and let me clean up your garden. Because you all showed me how to do that. Because I have to practice the opposite of those character defects. I told you I gave my mother a party on her 80th birthday. I kept asking her, you want a party? You want a party? No, I don't want a party. We tried to get her to come to Tennessee. I was still in California. I'm not coming there. It's too cold. Okay. 3 weeks before her 80th birthday, she calls my sister-in-law and says, I can't believe nobody's throwing me a party. See, that's the mixed messages I had growing up. And I call her up. Would you like to have a party? She goes, that would be lovely. So in 3 weeks, I throw a party for her and 50 of her friends. And I got a film thing done, you know, where you put all those pictures up, a beautiful cake and all this stuff. She kept telling me, Marion, this is so lovely. This is so lovely. Thank you. Turns out it's my mother's very first birthday party. 80 years old. And she got to have her first birthday party. Because of being clean and sober and practicing the steps, practicing the principles, and all of my affair, I'm able to provide this for my mother. You know, people go, oh, I love that you're making living amends. Book doesn't say living amends. I made amends. Now I live by spiritual principles. That's the difference. I try not to treat my parents the way I always treated them. I learned how to be giving and loving and thoughtful. Those weren't the traits I got here with, but they're the traits that you've instilled in me. By that steady hand of sponsorship that's taken me through these steps, by the fellowship that has rallied around me in those low times, and by the hand of a loving God, the God of my understanding that I found here in Alcoholics Anonymous, who've made those things possible for me. And if you're new, no matter where you can come from, that hand of God is always there. All we have to do is sweep away our prejudice, think honestly, and search diligently within ourselves. Then, if you wish, you can join us. Thank you.
Man, the transformations that I've seen this weekend. I mean, just whenever they're telling their stories. Thank you so much for, I mean. Woo! Man, I mean, you know, people, they dress up and they come up and they tell these stories and you're just like, oh my God, look at God at work, you know. You know, look at, so anyway, we are, I don't have, I got glasses, shit. Okay, it's 3:45, 4:15, we will start the panel, see what else. Remember the shirts. We broke, we need money. Okay, all right, what else? That's it, just pray out. Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not to temptation, but deliver us from self. For thy is the kingdom, power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Yay. Thank you. I'll see you in about 30 minutes.